There are lots of stories from the First World War. The story that I came across, which particularly touched me, was about a gentleman called John Abigail. He was from the city of Norwich, which is where I'm also from. John Abigail was born in 1897. He was one of eight children, the eldest. They family lived, it's fair to say, in grotesque poverty. His father, by 1916, was earning about 18 shillings a week. In January 1916, the National Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children visited John Abigail's home. They found the children infested with lice and bites. They were sleeping under sacks, nothing more, as a result of which three of the children were taken into the workhouse to be deloused. His father, who's probably an alcoholic, was sent to prison for child neglect. 2 months later, John Abigail is conscripted into the army. 4 months, just 4 months after that, he finds himself at the Battle of the Somme. During one attack, 80 of his friends are killed in one day. John himself is injured. We next come across John in Felixstowe in December 1916. He's probably suffering from shell shock. 2 months earlier, both his parents are imprisoned for child neglect once more. John finds out that his mother was released from prison on Christmas Eve. John's in Felixstowe in a camp. He goes back to see his family. He's the eldest of the children. He doesn't get permission, as a result of which he is arrested on Boxing Day and sentenced to 168 hours at detention. At the end of January, he visits his family home again without permission. This time it's because his father's been released from prison and he's clearly concerned about his brothers and sisters. He is arrested again. This time the sentence is docking of the pay, which is serious for the poor family, but also 14 days punishment, field punishment number one. Some of you may be familiar. This is where you're trussed up against a gun carriage wheel or something similar for hours on end, with only the barest of clothing in John's case. It was a cold winter. He had 14 days of this punishment. Very soon after that, in May 1917, he finds himself at the Battle of Arras. He deserts again, is arrested again, and is sentenced to 10 years penal servitude. That is commuted and pending an appeal. Now that's really unfortunate for John, because what happens is he finds himself at the Battle of the Somme with his mates in the Norfolk Battalion. For 10 days, he and his mates listen to 4 million shells whizzing overhead. John's probably, as I said, suffering from shell shock. As a result, he deserts yet again. He is arrested very quickly. He is brought before a court-martial. John's a broken man, I think. He doesn't speak in his defence. He doesn't call witnesses. He doesn't ask for any representation. As a result of which, after a hearing which probably lasted about 20 minutes, he is sentenced to death. 16 days later, Field Marshal Payne confirms the sentence. This is Field Marshal Payne, who refused to visit the sick in hospital, who dined on turtle soup at Christmas 1914, who knew none of the privations of the likes of John Abigail. On the 11th of September, John's sentence is read out to members of his own company. The members of the company draw lots as to who is to shoot John Abigail. He is shot by his own mates. This is a disciplinary procedure in more ways than one. He is killed the day after, age 22. Now, I tell this story because why it really touched me, I think probably I'm not the only one in the room, because when they read this stuff in the public library, it's been reduced to tears. So I have no shame about that whatsoever. But because it seems to me it encapsulates how poverty at home and fear on the front line drove millions to resist the war. And what I want to do for the next little while is just to make an argument. And the argument is this, that the 20,000 conscientious objectors were the tip of the iceberg, and that there were millions also who were driven to resist war. And I want to say, argue three things in particular. First of all, the initial enthusiasm and patriotism is overstated. Secondly, that the conditions that people faced on the home front and at the real front meant that people were driven to resistance. And lastly, in 1917 in particular, millions of people were driven into strike action, into mutiny, which merged into demands to end the war. Let me start with the first bit about the enthusiasm for war. An awful lot is made of the patriotic type at the beginning of the war. And in one sense, this is obvious. So in September 1914, some like 462,000 young men volunteered to join the British Army. They were surrounded by crowds cheering them on. Now that's a bald fact, but what I want to suggest to you is that it's not the only fact. First of all, let's look at the crowds. On the 3rd of August, the day before Britain joined the war, a crowd gathered outside Buckingham Palace, a patriotic crowd. Some historians say that it was 60,000 people. More serious historians, not necessarily left-wing ones, Mel Ferguson, for example, puts a figure at 20,000. This is not a huge number. But even when you think of the number of people joining, volunteering, the fact is that only 25% of those people who could have volunteered actually did volunteer. And this resistance carries through. You also have to ask, why did people volunteer? What people forget is at the beginning of the war, there was a recession. In Bristol, for example, 9 out of 10 people who lost their jobs in the first months of the war joined the army. There's more than one form of conscription. There's economic conscription as well. Since we live in the age of opinion polls, I looked at opinion polls. There's one that the only one I can come across, one held in France, a survey of 6 departments. And this one found that at the point when troops were actually marching through the streets, were mobilised, only 40 to 50% of those public opinion could be described as having patriotic fervour. So this is right at the peak when people were marching, when to Belgium and so on and so forth. So this is at the peak. 20% of those surveyed had negative opinions. So I'd say this is another example of how that initial patriotism is overstated. The second argument I want to make is the conditions at home and at the front line force people to resist. The conditions at home, let me say this. In every country, there is massive resistance to poverty in the First World War. In this country, most famously, in autumn 1915, the Glasgow landlords were making a pretty penny out of putting up the rents for the munitions workers flowing into the city. As a result of which, there was a massive rent strike led by the women of the city. Several of them were dragged before the sheriff's courts in November 1915. As a result of which, 15,000 people marched on the courts, dragging out with them six factories and shipyards to demand the charges against the rent strikers have dropped. They win. Not only do they win, but the government institutes legislation to control rents and give tenants more rights that last until Margaret Thatcher. Now, I can't say Margaret Thatcher in Chesterfield without approval. But it lasts until Margaret Thatcher. In Brunswick, in Germany, in 1916, many young people are forced into the factories. One in seven miners in Germany were teenagers. In Brunswick, the local military commanders decide to dock the pay of the young people until they're 21. As a result, the young people take to the streets, they strike, they riot, they clash with the military. The trade union leaders who previously stood aside eventually decide to support them, and the military commanders have to back off from docking the young people's pay. In Turin, in Italy, 1917, this is a city of 400,000 people. In August, one day, one in August, signs go up across the 80 bakeries in the city saying, no flour, no bread. There was flour to make the sweet breads for the rich in the centre of the town. As a result of which, the women of the city march, demonstrate, they pull factory after factory up on strike. There are barricades erected across the city. Homemade bombs are thrown at the troops. The movement is only broken after 4 days following the shooting dead of 50 of the protesters. Now, these sorts of movements were also replicated in the army, against the conditions in the army. And these protests started very early on. In the autumn of 1914, there's a whole series of rebellions in the camps across southern England. People refusing to fall in to parade. Now, that's a breach of military discipline, so it's serious stuff. Their complaint was poor accommodation and poor beds. Now, at this point, I should warn the parents in the room never to supply bad beds or hard beds to your children, because it will incite definite certain riot and rebellion. Because it also crops up in Russia in 1916. There's 2 days of rioting by thousands of troops demonstrating against hard bunk beds. Down with hard bunk beds. And lots of different people get caught up in this protest. The British Army, led by, drew in thousands of Egyptian and Chinese workers to work in the forts. They did so on the promise that they would leave to go home. In Boulogne, in September of 1917, rumour went round that the Chinese and Egyptian workers would be allowed to go back home. So they struck and they rioted. Bill Parcel Payne sent troops in with the order to shoot to kill. 27 of the protesters were shot and killed. Interestingly enough, some of the troops who were sent in to put down the strike also turned their weapons upon a cafe containing the officers who were given the orders. This is the level of the resistance. But I then also want to say this, that these strikes and mutinies begin to merge. The mutinies, by the way, are massive. Between 1917 and 1918, 2 million German troops walked away from the front. After the Battle of Caporetto in Italy, 400,000 soldiers walked away from the front. They broke ranks. They said, we've had enough, we're going. But what happened in 1917 was the strikes and mutinies merged. Most famously, in February 1917, the women textile workers, 90,000 of them in St. Petersburg, went on strike over bread. The troops were sent in to put them down, but actually refused effectively to put them down. Within weeks, more desertions on the Russian front. column of 50,000 soldiers, 15 miles long, marched to St. Petersburg, where they were greeted at the Narva Gate by workers from the Kutilov Works. And then on the banners now was, "We want bread, down with war." And that was a slogan which then was put on the banners across Europe, in Austria, in Germany, in France. France is often forgotten here. In April 1917, the women's seamstresses of Paris went on strike. They went on strike and won a 5.5-day week. At the same time, the French generals had launched a new attack at Chemin des Dames, an attack which was as pointless as all the other attacks. 147,000 soldiers killed by the end of the month. In an attempt to push the troops forward once again, the French military was faced by a mutiny which encompassed 500,000 troops. They called workers' councils, Soviets, just like the Russians. They wrote back to their friends and lovers in Paris saying, "We are doing like the Midinettes." The Midinettes were the women seamstresses who'd gone on strike. They commandeered a train to go to Paris to spread the movement. The officers of the army were restricted to their own tents. This is an absolutely massive rebellion, and one that was only put down after was 450 or so death sentences passed, 50 of which were carried out. Well, it is a quiz. We should have some quiz music. Okay. It's still going. Okay. Yes. Now all this comes to a peak in Germany. Now the German army, as I said, has suffered enormously. 2 million have walked away from the front. They've launched a push in March, and then were pushed back. But some parts of the German army want to carry on the fight. In October, they ordered their soldiers, the sailors, to sail out from Kiel into the North Sea to engage in a new battle. In Wilhelmshaven and in Kiel, the sailors put out the fires of the engines driving the ships. They refused to move. They marched, they were joined by tens of thousands of workers who also did what they did in Russia. They formed Soviets, workers' councils, demanding an end to war. Meanwhile, the trains were going. We should have had the music with the quiz earlier. That's fine. Okay. It's a good place to end, anyway. The trains that were going to the front in Germany had on them, "We don't fight for the Kaiser, we're fighting for millionaires." Long live Rosa Luxemburg, long live Karl Liebknecht. They were two German socialists who opposed the war. And because this movement was so strong, because they were saying, "We want bread, we want peace," the Kaiser was forced to abdicate on the 9th of November, and the German government was forced to say, "We prefer to conclude a peace than face a revolution at home against us." Now, what is amazing about all this is not just that there were millions taking part, not just that they were brave, like the 20,000 conscientious objectors, the 6,000 of whom were sent to prison, the 80 of whom who died, two in York committed suicide, they're probably not counted in the field. What is amazing is the bravery. But what is also amazing is this was done against whole-scale opposition. The massive repression, the soldiers' shot for desertion, the imprisonment, the defence of the railway, which banned strikes and did mortgage strikers, that the official Labour parties, that the trade unions all fell in to support the war. Despite all that, millions resisted. And because millions resisted, millions in the end put their mark on history and ended the First World War.